From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on July 18th, 10 days ago, at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio. One of the headlining speakers on night one of the RNC was Melania Trump, wife of presidential nominee Donald Trump. Melania spoke glowingly about Trump's loyalty, his devotion to those closest to him, and even though she didn't offer specific vignettes to amplify the themes, the speech was generally well received. But then, a laid-off journalist sitting in an L.A. Starbucks started comparing Melania Trump's speech to Michelle Obama's speech from 2008, and he found two full paragraphs that were nearly identical, not just in theme, but in language. The Trump campaign at first dismissed allegations of plagiarism, despite the evidence, but several days later, the campaign not only conceded that the passages had been lifted, they released a statement from a staff writer who took responsibility, offering to resign. The writer called it an honest mistake. And plagiarism is almost always described as an honest mistake, isn't it? In 1987, Senator Joe Biden was running for president when news broke that he had lifted entire pages when writing a law review article back at law school. Biden insisted, yes, it was a mistake, but not malevolent. Teachers across the country who deal with plagiarism in their classrooms view these kinds of episodes as chances to reopen the conversation with their students. Why it matters. Why language matters. Why citing your sources matters. This hour, a conversation about language, about plagiarism, and also about the power of great writing. My guests include Kurt Smith, a presidential speechwriter himself, an author, and a senior lecturer in English at the University of Rochester. Kurt, nice to see you again.
Great to be here.
And Evie Fanning is here. She's a high school English teacher who I know has a lot to say on these related subjects, and we've talked to her before about the classics, about literature. Now we get to talk a little bit about language specifically. Nice to see you, Evie. Thanks for being
here.
Very
glad to be here.
Kurt, I want to start with you. I was a little surprised to see you. You told the Democrat and Chronicle you thought this was much ado about nothing, the Melania Trump thing. Have you changed your view on that?
No, I think that there are different gradations in and among the speeches, and there's a different approach between the written word and the spoken word. The spoken word almost always is given not off the cuff necessarily, but certainly I think with much less foresight, much less time devoted to it than something that is given, for example, as a term paper, as you just alluded to. Mm-hmm. A term paper is almost by default something that you have a week, 2 weeks, at least some of my classes might have a month. It could be the defining barometer of your entire term in terms of a student's final grade. And so any similarity in word choice, in sentence similarity, in the choice of a paragraph, let's say, to lift in terms of similarity or not, you have to assume is quite deliberate. Now, that's not necessarily true with a speech, especially with someone who is writing for the First Lady. I don't mean, and I don't wish, to degrade or to be pejorative in terms of anyone who writes or will write for the First Lady or a prospective First Lady. But it's not basically the person who is the primary principal in the White House. That, of course, would be the president. And I think basically that Mrs. Trump, who has not given a great deal of public speaking herself in terms of policy or anything that would include policy, simply tumbled and bumbled into a situation not necessarily of her own making. If she had known that this was identical in this sense, she clearly would not have made the decision. If her husband had known of this, that would have been repeated as well. And so anyone on, boy, I won't say the JV team, because we've already had that adapted by our beloved president. But anyone in the White House working for the A team, and that would be the president, I don't think that you would see a chance in a million that this would be plagiarized or anything that would lead to charges of plagiarism. But someone working rather young and working with someone, not simply rather young, for a prospective First Lady and rather new to America as far as that's concerned, and working with a speechwriter that had not been around the road too much. Yes, I can see where that would occur.
But in this case, the woman who took responsibility in the Trump campaign is a Trump company speechwriter named Meredith McIver, who's 65 years old. Not young, not someone who's never been around the block, Kurt, right?
Right, but she hadn't, worked in terms of the kind of policy that you would expect from a presidential speechwriter or a head speechwriter for the wife of a president either.
All right, let's listen. I want to listen. Interesting. You've probably seen them side by, you know, back and forth, but somebody actually cut Melania Trump and Michelle Obama at the exact same time. Let's listen to their comments in these passages, how similar they are.
The values that you work like, hard for what you
work
want
hard
in life.
For what you want in life.
That your word is
that
your bond.
Word is your bond,
you
that you do what you say you're going to do.
Keep your promise.
That you treat people,
that you treat people with respect.
With dignity and respect, and
because
we want our children and all children in this nation to know that the only limit to the height of your achievements is the reach of your dreams and your willingness to work hard for them.
All right, so I just want to at least set the baseline. I understand your point that this is, first of all, not a native English speaker, someone who hasn't given a lot of speeches and probably doesn't love the limelight, Kurt, but we can still call a spade, and that's plagiarism, right?
Well, let us also establish something that's rather irrefutable, and that is the incredible bigotry of the national press, which I thought probably had reached its summit with Kennedy versus Nixon in 1960, or perhaps, let's say, 1992 with Clinton versus Bush, but determined even to set a new low for media bias. We've already seen an incredible inclination, Trump being disfavored versus the Democratic candidate, and of course Mrs. Clinton. I think that the rhetoric on behalf of her has just begun. This story.
I didn't ask you about Clinton, though.
Well,
this is plagiarism, right?
This, incidentally, how many weeks are we now since then? Two.
It's been 10 days. Yeah.
10 days? Okay. This obviously hasn't dented to a scintilla Donald Trump's appeal.
That's not the point.
Wait a minute. Or it is very much the point. Or his appeal versus any Democrat, because he's taken the lead
Nothing dents him.
Can I answer this question?
Well, what about Hillary Clinton in terms of her illegality? That's the choice that's being given the American people, which was exactly
Senator
my
Smith,
first point.
Senator Smith, I didn't ask you about this race. I just asked you. You're a speechwriter and someone I greatly – you're a writer. You're a speechwriter. You're someone I respect. I just want to know baseline first, because it's not just about Melania Trump. I mentioned Joe Biden. We're going to talk more broadly.
Well, you give me a single –
is this plagiarism?
You give me a single standard and we'll embellish at greater length. Okay. We don't have a single standard in the U.S. of A.
Whew.
And we haven't had one for several decades right now. Is it plagiarism? Yes.
Okay. Evie Fanning, go ahead.
I was just going to say yes.
You're going to answer in much shorter fashion?
Well, there is a definition of plagiarism. We do have the MLA style guidelines. There is a definition of what plagiarism is, and that is the textbook definition of plagiarism. Usually the plagiarism that we see is not that blatant. This is actually a fairly simple case of plagiarism.
Yeah, I mean, I thought so too. And I thought the odd thing, you know, you talk about media bias. I thought Chris Cuomo, who has not really distinguished himself that highly this campaign, did a much better job when he said to Paul Manafort 48 hours later, when Paul Manafort was trying to say, oh, you're making up a story out of nothing. And Chris Cuomo just said, stop lying. Acknowledge it, and then we can move on. I mean, that's what I don't get, Kurt. Why can't we just look at reality as reality? You know, this isn't about media bias. I love language. I love great writing. I'm somebody who cares deeply about it. I'm not giving up on the notion that great writing can still exist. It's why I called you. I don't know why we can't just say that.
Tell me the day that Governor Cuomo was adamant and he told us all that he thought Hillary Clinton should go to jail for the illegality that she's committed. I must have missed that. Been out of the country that day.
But we're talking about speeches. I mean,
we're talking a single standard. We're talking the lack of hypocrisy, which does not exist, sadly, in any discussion of language in this country today.
Okay, so I take the point that you feel the media is biased.
Incidentally,
favor
my
of
view,
Clinton.
if you look at polling data, is supported by a majority of Americans.
I think the media leans left. I don't. I asked you to acknowledge reality and the plagiarism. I'll acknowledge reality.
Sure, I do.
Oh, of course. And I think the media leans left. But that's not where I kind of, that's not sort of the point here. I want to at least set the baseline that says, what happened last week? And I want to talk about how speeches come together and why this matters. So I want to, Evie, I want to ask you, you're going to talk to students in class in the fall. Is this subject going to come up? I mean, is this incident going to come up?
We will definitely talk about plagiarism. This is an example that I won't have to bring up because my students will bring it up as they start talking about lifting information and using other people's words or ideas and presenting them as your own. Yeah, they will have all heard of this and they're going to bring it up. And one of the things that we're going to talk about, as you just said, is the response to something like that is just as telling. The defense to plagiarism is always that it was a mistake. It was an honest mistake. It was unintentional. I forgot to cite. I forgot where I heard this, etc. But how you deal with something like that is equally important. And I think if in the aftermath of this, the response to Melania's speech was, yes, I'm inspired by this woman. I used her words because, in fact, my values are very close to those of this woman who is greatly respected by society. I think we would see that as a strength. I think it's a great skill to be able to learn from other people, to be able to be inspired by other people, but that's not the same as stealing from other people.
Yeah, and you're right when you say that, boy, almost nobody comes right out and says, you got me, I stole. I mean, let me read from Joe Biden's article. This is from, that he wrote for the Fordham Law Review in May of 1965. This is the kind of sentence that you just, even a lawyer, I don't think, can write on their own because the language is so specific. But this is one of the sentences in the pages of stuff that was apparently plagiarized by Joe Biden. Quote, the trend of judicial opinion in various jurisdictions has been that the breach of an implied warranty of fitness is actionable without privity because it is a tortious wrong upon which suit may be brought by a non-contracting party. End quote. That was word for word from a previous article. Joe Biden's entire Law Review article had one footnote total. And he said years later, this is much ado about nothing. It was not malicious. I was just confused about what I had to cite. You know, how do you get confused about what you have to cite? So I want to ask, and I think Kurt can talk about as a professor, but also as a speechwriter. Abby, I'll just ask you as a teacher, as an English teacher, what are the standards for your students? Because it's not always entire passages. It's not always an entire page. Sometimes there's a sentence or just a piece of a sentence or an expression or a turn of phrase. How do we start setting standards for what you have to sort of give credit for?
And in fact, it doesn't even have to be exact words. If you paraphrase somebody else's ideas, somebody else's points, that's still plagiarism. Plagiarism is borrowing words or ideas. Mm-hmm. In this case, we have both. So intent is somewhat important. There's definitely an ethical piece to this because the legal definition is very narrow. So the question is, I think when somebody speaks, when I speak, even before I get to the subject of what I'm talking about, I am implying two things. One is that I have something to say. And two is that I'd like you to listen to it. And so if I plagiarize, if I'm using other people's words or other people's ideas and presenting them however I wish, I'm nullifying that first implicit claim right away. I don't have anything to say, in fact. So if I'm saying something when I have nothing to say, that's probably plagiarism. And I think it's offensive to your audience as well, because now you're misleading them by suggesting that you'd like them to listen to something that you have to say when, in fact, you don't have anything of your own.
How often do you see plagiarism in your own class?
Not that often.
Not that often.
We actually take a very active, preemptive approach to it. We talk about plagiarism. We read the definition of plagiarism. All of our students sign an academic honesty agreement where they explain that they understand what plagiarism is. They understand how to avoid it. They understand the repercussions that come with it. So we talk about it. We talk about it formally, technically, how to avoid plagiarism. We also talk about why it's very important, especially in an educational system, especially as a student, not to plagiarize. Authentically, honestly, to avoid plagiarism, to avoid intellectual theft.
Okay. Kurt Smith, what do you think?
Well, I think a lot depends upon the introduction that you give to your class and the discussion that you have with them so that nothing is misunderstood as a student begins the process of deciding what they want to write about and how long it should be, the kind of margins you should have, where the sources should be, what they should include, the fact that in any course, whether it be public speaking or presidential rhetoric, other courses that that students take, that they will include something called a book, and that something called a book will be gleaned from something called a library, you know, which is probably new terrain for some students. Not necessarily at the U of R, but some other students at schools that I won't you know,
yes,
mention.
Sure.
In any event, you know, I infer that the discipline might be, you know, I've got the ruler and you've got the knuckles. And no, I wouldn't. Donald Trump would say that, but I won't say it. So as you look at it, I simply tell them that you know what plagiarism is, I assume, after having been through high school and college. Then I give them a brief overview if they don't already. And then I say in brief that you won't do it and you mustn't do it. And I'm speaking to you less as a professor and student, rather as someone who wishes you well. I said, because plagiarism can be disastrous. In fact, will be disastrous to your career. So why should you attempt it now to cut a couple corners, say 5 or 10 minutes? That's not much of a return on investment. And so basically I tell them, so simply don't do it. And there are two reasons for that. Number one, it's wrong. And although I realize that that integrity is somewhat out on vacation, MIA somewhere in the culture of 2016, it does matter. And secondly, because it's stupid. It doesn't take, let's say, in a class of 40 people, it doesn't take 40 people to know that you committed plagiarism. It only takes one. Only takes one to come to me. Anonymously through the internet, or coming to me in some other way, for me to glean that student A is playing fast and loose, too fast and loose with the facts. That there is the end of his hope to gain any kind of honor from that class, and basically from the administration. I've been lucky. I've been teaching this course, both courses, for nearly 20 years, and have not had yet, knock on wood, one problem yet with cheating. And I like to say maybe because of putting the fear in God in them, although, you know, that would be giving myself, I'm sure, too much credit, and God simply too little. So I'm not going to do that.
But let me also, I want to actually go back to Joe Biden, but only to last night. He said something last night when I watched his speech last night at the Democratic National Convention, a line that stood out in my brain. This is Joe Biden from last night, talking about leading by example. And the phrase he uses here, I immediately said, hey, wait a second. He didn't write that. Let's listen.
The 21st century is going to be the American century because we lead not only by the example of our power, but by the power of our example. That is the history of the journey of America.
Now, when he says we lead by not only the power of our example, but the example of our power, but the power of our example. He didn't write that. I've not only heard that in other speeches. I've seen it in other places. Kurt, when does something become so publicly used? Should he have said, as a wise man once said, mm-hmm. Or should he have tried to actually ascertain the original source for that? Or is it so commonly used as a turn of phrase that he doesn't have to?
Well, there comes a time when, because of a frequency of usage, when
sure.
your latter occasion occurs and you simply don't use it anymore because it's lived its usefulness, and so you don't join the parade of know-nothings who don't care to acknowledge that phrase was, you know, dropped out of usage 10 years ago. But I always like, because I you don't want to take the chance that even slightly are you misusing a phrase or a word. So you're always pluperfect in terms of being careful when you give a phrase. So, for example, if you don't know exactly and you can't find, although it's difficult to find anyone who can't find a usage in where it came from in 2016, then I think it's what you were talking about in terms of saying something to the effect of, As a noble person, as a noble, you know, nobleman or something of that ilk, give it a common usage, a third party usage to protect yourself, and then I think that is, and of course the worst of all is to use a common phrase and not give it any usage to pretend that it's yours, because then anyone can throw the epithets of plagiarism at you, and it's your fault, and you'll have to accept that.
And even if he doesn't get blamed for plagiarism here, the effect at the very least is that you heard that, and that makes you question his authenticity. I think it would lend him credibility to say, I have heard somebody say this, a phrase that I find thought-provoking is. You know, if he did give it credit and make it clear that this is not something that he just came up with, I think that would lend his statement credibility.
Yeah, and it's not the same as entire pages or entire passages or paragraphs. But in this case, why not just say, as a wise man once said, but let's take it even to a more micro level. I've been thinking about language, and we are, whenever we speak or write, we are the product of our own experiences, of our own learning, of our own book reading, of what we've heard others say, of what we've read from others. I said when I was writing the only book I've ever written, I said what made me a better writer was either reading great writing or terrible writing. Mediocre writing did me no service at all, but I really enjoyed reading terrible writing or great writing because it at least had me thinking. And it's impossible to know just exactly where our own language expression comes from. Our parents are big factors, our friends, our teachers, etc. But there's an argument to be made that there's nothing really original coming out of our mouths because of that, that we are this composite. At the same time, I wonder, and I'll start with Kurt on this. Let's say I'm driving along, I've got a speech next week, and I hear a turn of phrase and I go, oh, I like that. I've never heard that before. I really like it. It could be three words. It could be some kind of an analogy. And I say, I like that. And it's not a sentence. It's not a paragraph. It's just a turn of phrase. But I didn't come up with it. I heard it somewhere. Can I use it? At what point do we draw the line and say, this is so unique? You can't modify unique. This is unique in its expression, and I have to draw a source for it, or I can use it.
Well, two questions, really. And the first thing I would advise, because I've been burned by not doing this and very happy when I did, is to get into your a Lamborghini, and
who's?
Well, you can still work on the monthly payment, but to get see if you can turn right in your car on the surface of whatever road you are, and then get a notebook out, get a pen out, and write it down, because you know you're going to want to use that and use it soon, and we've all been there, and if we can't remember the phrase, we turn into very unhappy campers, and the furniture around us can suffer, okay? Because we're constantly booting it, and it's not a pleasant sight. So I would say that is something that we can use. I've written, a third of a speech at night when I wake up, and, some phrases, some paragraphs, and that kind of thing, and then contentedly I drop off. And in terms of the other point in your question, which was what now?
I think, when do we just acknowledge the fact
that
we're just sort of a product of our experience?
Well, I would say basically that if you want to use it, simply be quite content to tell the listening or the viewing audience how you got it. Just say basically last week, driving along in your Ferrari, and I want to be fair.
You keep
here.
Promoting it. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's all right. I'll get back to a Ford Falcon, which is about 45 years old, that I could afford in a couple of minutes. Just say, yeah, driving along last week, and this just came to me, because you can't lose in that sense. You don't have to suggest aberration.
It's still effective.
Yeah.
But you show the authenticity of
the
source.
Yeah, you don't need to suggest, obviously.
Probably bolsters credibility with the audience.
Yeah, you don't have to say who wrote it, because obviously you don't know who wrote it.
Right.
Or you'd say so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
Evie?
I'm going to, maybe to my own peril, actually disagree with both of you.
Oh.
One, on the point that integrity is MIA. And that
originality
is MIA.
I didn't agree with Kurt on that. Kurt, I want to, on a separate hour, sit down with Kurt and just try to put him on the couch. He's got a very dark view of things right now. And I tend to think, I've got a more sanguine view of the coming generation.
Oh, you must have loved Ford against Carter then.
Listen, I'm not nearly so pessimistic as Kurt, but that's another day for another
story.
Well,
so that's my beef with Kurt, is I don't think that integrity is MIA. Where I disagree with you is that nothing is new anymore.
Okay.
I think that it is. I think what's the joy in relaying somebody else's words? If you're writing a speech and you have something to say and you want to inspire and impress and enlighten, then say something that's yours. You know, come up with something that you want to convey, because that other thing that you heard, somebody already said that. It's not satisfying, as I see it, to relay that. Now, that may be a starting point for you that gets you thinking about some use of language that you find effective, and so you start using language in that kind of way. But ultimately, it should still be your language, I think.
You know, when I was in London at the New Globe, you know, they've got this little demonstration on how so many turns of phrase came from Shakespeare,
right.
And it really
is
remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
And so it had me thinking a couple of things. First of all, how truly brilliant Shakespeare was, that he is every bit as brilliant, or they, or whatever Shakespeare was,
right.
Not to start a whole other can of worms, but how remarkable that was, that this writer could create so many new turns of phrase that stuck in the language,
yeah.
that were so effective. But it also reminded me that I don't have to fall back on that this is hundreds of years later now, there are new ways to say things.
Right, and ultimately we end up at what Kurt was talking about, which is cliché. Something becomes so used that it is no longer effective at all, even to communicate its original intention.
I wonder how long a half-life Yogi Berra will have, because, you know, Shakespeare had 14, 15, 600, 700 years.
Something like that.
And
he's still going, I hope.
Well, Yogi Berra is still going, but of course that's a much shorter travel. We'll have to see, or more to the point, our great-grandchildren will have to see if they're using yogiisms, because he became this year in the United States at least, the front-running public figure in the United States in terms of being quoted by public speakers, passing William Shakespeare.
Isn't that amazing?
So it is amazing.
And he's the king of the malaprop.
That's true. Well, that says something about the culture there. But you mentioned that what's being true today. What's being new, rather, it seems to me. You know who's new? You know what? Who hasn't been tried before this year? Donald Trump. Donald Trump is new, if you want new.
Well, old is not the only potential problem.
Donald Trump's never been tried. Not like this.
You mean in a court of law? As a
political phenomenon.
Yes, that's true. He has not.
Decimating an entire party.
And he did. Let's get our only break in, and we're going to come back, and I want to talk a little bit more about the difference between a term paper, a book report, a term paper that a student may hand in Evie Fanning or Kurt Smith's class, versus a speech. Because when we talk about speeches, what we saw last night, what we saw last week, often those speeches were largely written by other people and then massaged into form by the person actually delivering the speech. Now, if I went into Evie's class as a student and said, here's my paper, my mom wrote this thing and I tweaked it a little bit, you probably would be much more offended. But we are absolutely accepting of that on the national stage of speech making. Is that okay? And let's talk about the difference after this short break on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, the Summer of Food continues on Connections, our series of conversations about agriculture, food, wine, drink, everything related to it. And we're going to sit down with a woman whose family was some of the first to warn the Finger Lakes community about fracking. They had seen it up close near the Pennsylvania border. Now, they're not just activists, they're making cider, fermented cider. We'll talk about that next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Evie Fanning is a high school English teacher, and Kurt Smith is a presidential speech writer, an author, and a senior lecturer in English at the University of Rochester. And I'm really proud that Kurt eventually acknowledged that Melania Trump's speech had contained plagiarism, despite the ululations on media bias. But we at least had a baseline there. And we're talking plagiarism. We're talking about how speeches come together. And we're talking about, I think at times, the difference between a speech and a paper, a written article. It could be an editorial. But obviously there are differences. And before our short break, I mentioned that, you know, Kurt, part of your job was presidential speech writing. You wrote speeches for George H.W. Bush.
Right.
Let's just take an example. Choose any speech you want. How much of that speech, when you set out to write a speech for him, I would assume there are varying degrees of independence or interdependence. You know, some presidents probably want to have more hands-on. Barack Obama is sort of famously more hands-on. Some probably want to be less hands-on. How does the process work?
Well, this depends almost totally on whom you're writing for. And that can vary wildly, mm-hmm. and it does. Each president basically has five speechwriters, and if I can basically be general, each of those speechwriters has one assistant. And this is the way I think speechwriters write best, is that is you, that you have the principal, the subject for whom the speech is written, and then the speechwriter, and then the speech assistant. So there is a uniformity of style throughout, which is exactly what you want. So what you do is you have, from the very get-go, find out where the event is held, find out what the event is, talk with your assistant on, geez, you know, where did the boss, where did the old man, and, you know, you have someone like Mrs. Clinton, who's 68, 69, and Donald Trump, who's 71, or I think maybe they're reversed. And so I don't know what they call them, but in any event, you know, you have some fond, sympathetic name. And you ask, where have they spoken before? Have they spoken about the subject before? Because you don't wish to repeat yourself. You can't use the same jokes twice if you go in the same market. And this brings up the over-reliance on repeating yourself, repeating the same jokes, not simply as you go back to the same market twice, let's say within 2 years, but a sense of repeating yourself, which is I think the single most, sameness reason that I love speech writing. In a book, you don't see that you're repeating yourself. Each book is somewhat different. In a speech, you begin to repeat yourself. You find out that a joke works. Bingo! You register it in your mind. And so maybe 3-4 months down the line, it's 11 o'clock at night. You're trying desperately to find some joke that works about topic A. And you say, ah, that works, will work, because it did work. And so you roll it out. And you're not really improving as a writer. You may be, helping the candidate because you're giving him a good line that will work again, but you don't grow necessarily as a writer. And I think you find a lot of people leaving that as a career to go back into the writing of magazine pieces or books because it's a bit more challenging in that sense. But you work together. And if I can use the name of the greatest president, I think, of the past century, and certainly with the greatest speech writing team of the past century, and that is Franklin Roosevelt. He had five speechwriters at every one time, but he was able to work with them. And of course, he had a style of his own, but his writers did as well. One was an Emmy Award winning writer. Another was an Emmy Award winning playwright. Another was someone who worked in Hollywood. And another was someone who worked in the armed forces. So he had people coming to him, writing for him, who already had indelible styles, who were extraordinarily distinguished in their own field. And Roosevelt somehow got them to write for him, got them to sublimate these styles, which they had used successfully all their life, throw those styles at the door. And when they were writing for Roosevelt, they were writing as just as FDR would say.
That's, just as FDR would
it's
say.
Amazing. Amazing. And so it was that with some exceptions, the Pearl Harbor speech that we've all heard, the magnificent speech which brought America together after Pearl Harbor, as indeed it already was, a number of speeches like that. But he understood, as no president I think has, the magic of rhetoric and how you could use that to unify a nation and in his sense, to unify the free world.
But no one can walk into your classroom and hand you a paper and say, I had a team write this, I massaged it, here's the final thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not the same, but explain why. Why is that different?
Because they're not getting paid for it, for one thing. They're getting paid to develop their style. I've already had my style, or developed my style, and have suffered the slings and arrows of criticism by the time that I would deign to be a teacher. They haven't. And at some point in their life, if they work hard and if they do speech after speech after speech, then they will be in the chair where I am sitting now. And they will be talking to some student in the manner that I am talking now. That's what I would do.
And in the classroom, then, they are establishing their own thoughts, their own voice, et cetera.
Yeah.
And the political stage, they have already done that, and speechwriters are only trying to create something for them that would work from their own experience and background.
That's right. And you have to develop your own voice because, there are, for example, in the Bush White House, I wrote, helped write several States of the Union address, which are the God most awful kind of speech. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy in the world because you age about 20 and a half years and about 2.5 months. It is a pathetic process to see someone age before you. But to do that where you write a speech literally one-on-one with the principal or to write a speech in which you're trying to act basically as a comedic funny man. Mm-hmm. Roosevelt was able to do that, for example, with his famous "My Little Dog Fala." He was able to utilize the English language for every kind of speech that you could imagine. Churchill once said that that words are bullets that you use as ammunition. And he used them against Nazi Germany to win a war. We have to use them here in a way that maybe you're running for Congress, maybe you're trying to sell something as a salesman, but whatever it is, to sell yourself.
All right, before I turn to Evie Fanning, I'll just remind our listeners, I've seen some comments coming online. If you want to call the program and weigh in on this, toll free, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. First of all, I want to ask you to kind of elaborate on a discussion we had off air this morning, which is when it comes to writing for someone's style, you're very perceptive on language, I have to say, Evie. And you pointed out that a great speechwriter may be able to understand how someone would say it, but we all have our own verbal tics. We have our own styles and our own turns of phrase that we go to more often than not. By the way, when you do 500 hours of radio a year and you go back and actually read the transcript, you'd be horrified of how awful your own speech is. And I've been really beating myself up on that. But the bottom line is we all have our own styles.
Right.
Is there a peril in thinking that you can figure out when someone would use an expression and when they would not?
Well, on one level, it definitely seems like a strength, right? That that a speechwriter can appropriate his speaker's voice and write in that person's voice, because, of course, that will make it more believable. That would make it sound more genuine. On the flip side of that, that sort of deliberate ruse seems even more disingenuous, where now it's not just a matter of, you know, helping somebody who's not a native speaker deliver her ideas more eloquently. Now it becomes, I'm going to format my own ideas in such a way that they definitely sound like they came from your head. And I think that is kind of a gray area. Certainly, it's not having a speechwriter write a presidential speech is not the same as my student having her father write her paper. But there is something similar to it. There is. There is this notion that when we're speaking in first person, we're implying that we are conveying our thoughts in our words. And even though technically we all know that there are speechwriters, there is this suspension of disbelief, and the speechwriters and the speakers are both knowingly, deliberately perpetuating that. So I guess we're saying the difference is it's a student's job to be a good writer, and it's not the president's job to be a good speaker. And I don't know to what extent that's really true. I think maybe somebody who's a politician, who is a public representative, it is his job to be a good speaker and a good writer.
Well, let me expand on a part of the point that Kurt was making on knowing the material that you've written for yourself already that you can mine, whether it's a joke or something else. Because the night after Melania Trump had her issue, Donald Trump Jr. spoke, and for a brief moment, the world was buzzing that there was another plagiarism scandal, but there's something more to it. Let me go ahead and read a transcript. This is from the transcript, night two of the Republican National Convention last week. Donald Trump Jr., quote, "Our schools used to be an elevator to the middle class. Now they're stalled on the ground floor. They're like Soviet-era department stores that are run for the benefit of the clerks and not the customers, for the teachers and the administrators and not the students." Well, a couple of months earlier, the American Conservative magazine, written by F. H. Buckley, had an article with the following passage. Quote, "What should be an elevator to the upper class is stalled on the ground floor. Part of the fault for this may be laid at the feet of the system's entrenched interests, the teachers' unions, and the higher education professoriate. Our schools and universities are like the old Soviet department stores, whose mission was to serve the interests of the sales clerks and not the customers." End quote. So very clearly borrowed, but it turned out that F. H. Buckley, who wrote that article, helped Donald Trump Jr. write the speech. And so at first everybody sort of said, okay, that solves that. F.H. Buckley said, I wrote the article, I also helped write the speech, it's no big deal. But others said, well, look at Jonah Lehrer. He lost his career for self-plagiarizing, for lazily going back and borrowing his own material and presenting it as if it's a new idea. And should Buckley, who's getting paid to write a speech, be mining his own material and then allowing somebody else to present it as their own? Or should he be writing something with new turns of phrase, new expressions, new ideas? Kurt Smith, what do you think of that?
Well, I think that, I mean, my view, I think, may tell me if it does, but vary somewhat from some of the folks that you've just quoted. I see nothing wrong whatever in basically promoting your own views and in repeating your own words. I can't imagine, it makes no sense to me, someone to say to me that I can't plagiarize myself, that I can't repeat myself. Is this what they're saying?
Well, I think
that makes no sense on any score.
All right, so there's a couple of issues there. But you just said that there's a great value in a speechwriter understanding how the speaker for whom they are writing would talk and express themselves.
Yeah.
And yet Buckley here wrote for Donald Trump Jr.
Yeah.
And didn't say, what do you think? How can we phrase it? Or
oh, I'm gonna,
or I'll create a phrase that I think mm-hmm. you would say.
Right.
He took something that is obviously a unique expression. Mm-hmm. I thought a very clever and well constructed expression that he had already written for a separate article.
So what you're saying is, if I can paraphrase here, is that the what you object to is the fact that it was stupid and didn't work, rather than that it's lazy and that it's wrong.
No, I think if someone is writing a speech for me,
yeah.
I want them to try to understand my views, my history, my views on policy and ideas, and express it as best we can, and then we're going to sit down together and work it out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want them to say, hey, I wrote this article a couple of months ago. I liked this phrase that I wrote for myself,
right.
And you read it.
I see.
Isn't that different?
I suppose tangentially. It is amazing what you can do when the words aren't coming to you from above and when the deadline clock is staring at you from above and you get desperate. But I don't know. Over a long cup of coffee, I probably could come to an answer to this.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah, I can understand your point. What I thought at first was that you were saying that you cannot repeat, promote yourself, because obviously words are sacred, and the most sacrosanct is words that you write for yourself, which are yours.
Yeah, okay. You know. Evie, what do you think?
Well, a couple things. First of all, if he published this and it's copyrighted, then they don't belong to him anymore, and he can't sell them now to somebody else. I mean,
that's
a separate issue.
Is there a legal, claim for the American Conservative magazine to say, hey,
once,
buddy?
Yeah, once it's published, it's copyrighted, it belongs mm-hmm. to the people who paid you for it the first time. You can't now turn around and sell it to somebody else. Not the same as plagiarism. So the writer didn't plagiarize. In a sense, the speaker did. Right, because the speaker said the words that were copyrighted by somebody else somewhere else, and I agree with you, Kurt, that it's lazy and it didn't work, and it's stupid. I mean, this is not an effective speechwriter. This is not an effective speech. And the degree of narcissism on the part of somebody who tries to pull this off on a public that clearly is paying attention is the most offensive part to me.
Well, you would think after the Melania Trump thing, the whole Trump team would be going, okay, the speech is tonight. Let's go over them.
Yeah, and here's the other thing. We're saying things like, well, this is not the president's speech, so it's not that important. This is just the wife. This is just the son. But I hold 14-year-olds accountable for this kind of thing every day. And they stand up to that responsibility. 14-year-olds can handle it. They know how to check whether something that they're writing has copyrighted by somebody else or wasn't.
Right.
So certainly a presidential nominee team can be held to that standard.
Yeah, I believe, in terms of standards of that ilk. But again, one thing that I would say is that, you look at this, and I guess probably if you were to be honest and ask speechwriters, they would probably say, under polygraph, even if they didn't say to you, is that, well, geez, I would or I wouldn't, depending upon the importance of the speech, how many people were listening or looking at the speech, and therefore, what are the odds that I would be found out by the speech? Okay? So if it's a 2,000 circulation magazine in Podunk County, yes, I'm going to take that chance. Who's ever going to see it?
Well, there you go.
As opposed to a giant metropolitan daily like the DNC.
Yeah.
Where you know you'll be found out.
Right. And this is where integrity comes in, because it's not just are you going to get caught, but are you actually saying something?
Yeah.
And before I grab one quick phone call, one more question, Kurt. If you had a student write a paper and you said, this is fabulous. A, I love the turns of phrase, very clever. And a year later, you're teaching a different class, same student, and they write a paper, and they've got entire paragraphs the exact same, but they're their own, and you assign them to write a new paper, would you say, well, they are your own, I get it, that's fine?
No, I would...
You wouldn't.
I would hold them responsible.
That's self-plagiarism, see?
Because it's also being lazy, and it's...
But you just said there's no big deal with self-plagiarism. Those words are your own.
Yes, I did.
There's a problem with being lazy.
Yeah, but there's an intellectual laziness there that is inexcusable.
Okay.
So I think there is a difference.
All right, Kate in Greece. Go ahead, Kate.
Oh, good afternoon. One thing I would like... First of all, we're talking about plagiarism, and I feel that someone needs to address the boring, repetitive messages coming from both camps. I said the key phrasing and catchwords, well, they're like the old models, and that may be making people run out of options with those models in what to say. And I'm just going to say this, metaphorically speaking, these good old party dogs on both sides, and maybe their speechwriters, they like nothing better than to get down and roll around in their overused rhetoric, and it's seriously getting on a lot of people's nerves. I think that somewhere where you see some younger, different phrasing, but it seems to me that they've created this mode or style, and they don't want to break out of it. So the plagiarism, in order to stay within those limits, it seems to me that plagiarism is very attractive at some point.
Okay, Kate, thanks for the phone call. Kurt Smith, you're nodding. What do you think?
I agree with that, and I think that the level of public discourse, which governs the level of political discourse, has worsened, has coarsened, has become more endemic, and has become more insipid. Why has that occurred? Because the culture is that way, which means that the American public, collectively and individually, is that way. The American people aren't as bright as they were 20 to 30 years ago.
Oh,
they don't watch. I know this is a shock. They don't read as much.
Well, that's true.
The television programming that they watch and that the networks insist that they watch because of options is not as good as it was 20 to 30 years ago. I had thought, obviously, rather mistakenly, that because of cable television, boy, the level of discourse is going to improve. Look at all the options that people they will have. Just what folks have been looking for, not true. What it meant was that even network television found itself, well, you know, we have so much pornography, we have so much obscenity, we have so much sensationalism, we have so much idiocy here and on cable, that we, the networks, are going to basically mime it. So what we've got is this swampland of idiocy, and we call that culture. Well, we call it some other things, too, which I'm not going to mention on the air.
Okay, well, we're down to our last minute. Kurt is definitely not as optimistic about the future generations. I don't disagree. We're reading less. That's a problem. Language skills aren't as good. That's a problem. But I'm much more optimistic. I want to take you on a tour of the places I go to. You're going to be much more optimistic. Evie, what do you think? Go ahead.
The American public is not any more stupid. There are not any fewer ideas, and there aren't any fewer new things to say than there were during any other generation trying to speak them. What we need to do is stop excusing this sort of nonsense. Stop saying that plagiarism is no big deal and it's okay to repeat ideas and these are common phrases, and hold people accountable and encourage people to actually speak their mind and say things that are true. There's a lot of pressure, I think, in our society. It is kind of a voyeuristic culture. People need to speak. We need to see them. I bet Melania Trump did not want to make a speech. I think we should have let her not make one.
Sure.
Because I think that there's a rare, very important and very rare skill in knowing when to be quiet. And perhaps that's something we should pay more attention to.
Kurt, 20 seconds.
This is the exception, not the rule. The first Democratic first lady to speak was Eleanor Roosevelt in 1944, and Pat Nixon in 1972, the first Republican first lady. Do you know what? They were far superior to this year's crop. Maybe we can go backward, not forward, because backward is forward.
We're coming off the best first lady speech in history this
week. Well, that's true.
Okay, but I take
one of them, not the best.
All right, well, but I take the point that they don't have to do this. Historically, it hasn't always been that way. Interesting history lesson. Great discussion. Kurt Smith, presidential speechwriter and professor at U of R. Thank you, Kurt. Great
to
see you.
You bet.
Evie Fanning, high school English teacher. Nice to see you, Evie.
Backward is not forward.
More connections next.